Attention, pleasure seekers. What if I told you there was a toy that was so iconic that it practically set the standard for all my favorite products? Allow me to introduce or reintroduce to you the Magic Wand. Dubbed the Cadillac of Vibrators, the Magic Wand is more than just a toy. It's a culture icon, a symbol of power and unapologetic pleasure. I mean, do you know any other toys that have been praised in Time magazine? Didn't think so. With a unique rumble that resonates deep within, the Magic Wand Original is not just a product, it's a trusted confidant. And it's a sure thing. Never had an orgasm? Try a Magic Wand. Never given your party a full body massage? Try the Magic Wand. Listen, it's rightfully earned accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades. I've been so obsessed with my Magic Wand, I even drilled holes in my bedside table so that she's always next to me in case I need her. Well, that was years ago, because now there are multiple iterations of the Magic Wand, allowing you to pick whatever model fits your lifestyle. You can go wireless with the Magic Wand Rechargeable, tiny with the Magic Wand Mini, or micro. Micro's really mini. Or go for variety with the Magic Wand Plush. The best part though, all of them have the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original so popular. So if you're ready to make some magic, visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to cast a spell on the world. Magic Wand, not just a vibrator, an icon of pleasure.
You know, we found in a very large study we did that of 40,000 gay, lesbian, and heterosexual couples, 80% of them said that fun had come to die in their relationship. People stopped really romancing one another. They stopped playing together and having fun and, you know, really having an erotic life with one another.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. No one goes to relationship school, so Dr. John and Julie Gottman created the Gottman Institute to find out what makes relationships work. As today's guests and partners for over 30 years, the Gottmans talk about their iconic research, including the myth of compatibility, the four behaviors that tank a relationship, and what is up with pheromones and attraction. Finally, we discuss the Gottmans' book, 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love, Intentions with Emily. For each episode, join me in setting an intention for the show. So what I mean is, when you're listening, what do you want to get out of this episode? Well, my intention was easy. I couldn't wait to introduce you to the revolutionary work of Drs. John and Julie Gottman so you can use their groundbreaking research and apply it to your own relationships. Please rate and review Sex with Emily wherever you're listening. It helps people find the show, and so more people can just prioritize their pleasure. Also, check out our new article, 9 Books for a Super Sexy Fall. If you want to ask me a question, just call my hotline. It's 559-TALK-SEX or 559-825-5739, or leave me your questions at sexwithemily.com/askemily. All right, everyone, enjoy this episode. Today, my guests are Drs. John and Julie Gottman. They are the founders of the Gottman Institute and have been married for over 33 years. Dr. John Gottman is world-renowned for his work on marriage and incredibly accurate divorce prediction. He's conducted more than 40 years of breakthrough research with thousands of couples and is the author and co-author of more than 40 books, including the best-selling The 7 Principles for Making Marriages Work. Dr. Julie Gottman is the clinical supervisor for the Couples Together Against Violence study, the co-creator of the immensely popular The Art and Science of Love weekend workshops for couples, and co-designed the National Clinical Training Program in Gottman Couples Therapy. She has co-authored or authored numerous books and is a clinical psychologist in the Seattle area. You can find John and Julie Gottman on Instagram at Gottman Institute and Twitter, Gottman INST. You can find everything at gottman.com. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon. I am so excited to meet both of you. I'm a huge fan. It's a great honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you.
Aww, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. You've helped so many of us, including myself, understand relationships and just the factors that contribute to having a healthy relationship, which so many of us don't understand. We don't get to go to relationship school. Most of us haven't had healthy relationships modeled. And I quote you guys all the time. think everyone does. And you're truly pioneers, really. Through the years of research and of observing like all these couples, you know, you now you learn where couples are actually struggling, where they struggle the most. I know this is often cited, but to give my listeners a better idea of the magnitude of your work, you can predict with confidence and incredible accuracy, in fact, 94% accuracy, what separates the masters of relationships from the disasters. In other words, you can tell which couples might be headed for divorce or a breakup. That's incredible.
Basically, that's true. However, that's a given that they're not getting any kind of intervention in the 6 years between when we first see them and later on when we find out what's happened to them. They came into the lab, they were hooked up to various physiology equipment, and they were videotaped and so on. And they would just have a couple of conversations with one another, each conversation for 15 minutes. They would also just be interviewed about the history of their relationship, and that was important. And then we'd say bye-bye. They'd leave the lab. And we'd check in on them every couple of years. And within about 6 years, we could tell based on that day they came into the lab, what would happen to them 6 years down the road with 94% accuracy, given that they didn't have any intervention, any therapy, for example, between when we saw them and when we checked in with them later.
Actually, if they got therapy, they were more likely to divorce than if they got no therapy. Yeah, that's what Bob Levinson and I found.
Bad therapy.
Yeah, it's always, but you know, things are different. In the last 25 years, Julia and I have worked together to create a new therapy and new ways of helping couples. And now things are much better. We can help people avoid relationship disaster and to some degree turn a disaster into a master.
You know, basically what happened is at first, and John started this work before he and I met 35 years ago. So about 45 years ago, he was working with his colleague, Robert Levinson, who is a professor at UC Berkeley. And they did a lot of the initial lab work determining what predicted divorce or staying together unhappily or staying together very happily. So they were the ones that determined those principles. And then we continued the work after John and I met. But what we also did 25 years ago is to make a decision that we wanted to create theory and interventions based on what we saw the successful couples do, try those out in a workshop, and then see whether or not they actually worked, fine-tune them, and then begin teaching them to therapists and doing the therapy ourselves, doing the workshops, and then it just spread like wildfire around the world because people really didn't know what successful couples were doing to make them successful until John and Bob figured it out.
I've heard this before, and I want to see if you think this is true, that sex, having kids, and money are three of the biggest challenges in a relationship.
Yeah, there's some truth in that, particularly the money disputes very often are labeled as the big predictors of divorce. But we've actually found that that's kind of a superficial view because arguments about money are almost always arguments about what money means. And underneath there is really about your values, about how to live life and what life means. So one thing that's happened during COVID to good relationships is people have really talked about their lives together and how they can have more meaningful connection in their lives. And so I think the fights about sex, money, and, you know, other things, really, a lot of times they're about the absence of connection, emotional connection, and physical connection. And they sort of are, you know, take a back seat to what really is vital in a relationship, keeping it alive.
Also, I think it's really important to stress that the topics, of course, are really important in terms of what couples fight about. Those are the most common things couples fight about. However, the way they fight is what predicts divorce, the way they fight. So they could be talking about who's going to hold on to the remote for the TV, and that can lead to a divorce because of the horrible ways that they're fighting. The ways that they're using those four horsemen instead of the antidotes to those, which have much more to do with describing yourself, describing your own feelings. I'm lonely. I really miss you. I miss touching you. Mm-hmm. Could we have a romantic night tonight? Asking directly for what you need and not asking in a way that says, would you please stop doing this? We call that a negative need.
Right, exactly.
But rather a positive need. You tell your partner how they can shine for you. And who doesn't want to shine for the other person, right?
Exactly. What are unsuccessful couples doing in relationships that differentiate them from successful couples?
So when they bring up a conflict, they're doing typically a lot of what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Yes.
And those are very big predictors of relationship demise. The first one is criticism, which means they'll look at a problem they're having and they'll blame the other partner and put the other partner down with criticism. You're so lazy. You never clean up the kitchen. What's the matter with you?
Here's what's wrong with you.
Here's what's wrong with you. So criticism. Secondly, they will use contempt. And contempt is a bit like criticism, but it's coming from a more superior place. So it has sarcasm sometimes. It will have an eye roll, you know, like, oh my God, really? Are you really that stupid? You know, that kind of stuff that if you have teenagers in your life, you've seen it a lot. Contempt turned out to be the worst thing for a relationship. It's really terrible.
Mm-hmm. Give me some examples of contempt, just so people really get it, what it might look like.
Sure. Oh, you think I'm driving too fast. Oh, you're scared. Oh, mockery. One, you slut, you disgust me. Name calling, contempt, sarcasm. You wouldn't even think of doing the laundry, would you? Doesn't even occur to you. You know, that kind of thing. It's even worse than criticism.
Okay.
So number three is defensiveness. Mm-hmm. So that's the hardest one, really, for people to do less of. We never really lose it altogether, but it's a response to feeling put down. Attacked. And so a person will be defensive by either being kind of a righteous victim, like, what do you mean? I do pay the bills on time. I always pay the bills, you know, that kind of thing. Or counterattacking. Oh, yeah? Well, you got a traffic ticket last week, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's counterattack. That's defensiveness, number three. And number four is what we call stonewalling. And stonewalling really means that during a conversation, you are in effect shutting yourself so completely down to the other person that you're not responding to them at all. You may not be looking at them at all. You don't say anything at all. And I'm not talking about a short pause, like a pause to think of an answer. It's for minutes at a time. There's no response, no head nod, no, I get it. Nothing. You're turning into a stone wall.
Okay. Those are the four that you observed with how many couples over the years now?
A couple of thousand, 3,000. One of the interesting things was that the masters of relationship, even if their partners were critical, rather than counterattacking and getting defensive or, you know, whining and acting like an innocent victim. They took responsibility. They said, that's interesting. You know, maybe I can be selfish and thoughtless at times. Tell me more about what you feel and tell me what you need. And that was a very different response than pushing off, you know, pushing away what the partner is saying. So that became a very different way of talking. Just, you know, saying, if you're upset, I really want to hear about it. And that really gave us a window into what it is that people are doing when relationships are going well.
Right. The way the partner reacts is sort of diffusing it.
Yeah.
And then that might actually turn it around.
That's right. Exactly.
So the thing is, I'm just wondering, is this the kind of thing when we see people doing this? Like, I just wonder, could we all learn that? Like, are there couples that have just been together a few weeks and they could just come to one of your labs and they could fit? Could we learn these skills? Because you'd save so much heartache. You'd save so many problems in relationships before they walk down the aisle. And I get many people won't even go through the door because they're riding the dopamine bliss of a new relationship. But I think that it's just so, I mean, now I think I've even heard you said you can predict it in under an hour. Because you are the masters, right? You
can buy Emily, you know, one of the things that we discovered is that in prevention, and when couples take a workshop, and usually they're really interested in taking a workshop to improve their relationship when they're expecting a baby, and they don't want the baby to be negatively affected by their arguing, and they just come to a workshop that lasts 10 hours, we can avoid all these negative consequences for almost 80% of couples. In just 10 hours.
These are the workshops that you do around the world, right?
We do a lot of workshops around the world, but this particular workshop was just an amazing research study. We didn't expect the results to be that good between the couples who expected a baby and did the workshop. It was a two-day workshop, 5 hours each day, and the couples who didn't do the workshop. But Lynn was right, 80% of those couples did really, really well compared to maybe about 25% of the couples who didn't do the workshop.
Right.
Wow. I mean, how can we make this a requirement? I mean, I would love all of my listeners to go, because I feel like, at least if you're listening now, try to sign up for a workshop, because I always tell my listeners that they really, therapy is crucial. I believe that everyone needs therapy. And really, I think it's a requirement. I think you know that something's going to happen at some point. You might as well get into therapy before there's a huge problem, but it's really hard to get people to do that. And so do you agree with that? What do you think? Do you think that most couples could benefit from therapy, the right therapy?
I don't know if I would say all couples, but certainly a large number of couples could really benefit from it. One of the things, Emily, that I would really love to see are high school kids getting a class in relationships, right?
Yes.
Because all those patterns get started so early, and they don't particularly change that much in adulthood. So if kids knew that criticism doesn't work if you're, you know, dating somebody, if they knew that it really helps to take responsibility for what you contributed to a negative incident and how to do that without kind of losing yourself, I think it would be tremendously helpful for kids, and they would probably end up making better choices of life partners later on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so much lacking in education for our youth. I always say that I wish they had comprehensive, accurate sex education, but to throw in communication.
Right.
So you're talking about kids, though, and tell me what you think about this, because I see it all the time that having kids is going to change your relationship in many ways.
Absolutely.
I hear from people when it's the sex. They stop having sex. They stop initiating sex. And so how much of that, have you ever talked to couples about that?
Yeah, one of the things that we discovered was that, and this was backed up by a study done at UCLA by the Sloan Institute, that especially for dual career couples, a lot of times everything takes priority over the relationship. The children do, the career does, and essentially relationships die by being ignored and they stop really having romance and playfulness and fun and adventure. You know, we found in a very large study we did that of couples about to start therapy, 40,000 couples, gay, lesbian, and heterosexual couples, 80% of them said that fun had come to die in their relationship. And that's what the Sloan study found as well, is that people stop really romancing one another. They stop playing together and having fun and, you know, really having an erotic life with one another.
Yeah.
A lot of new parents find sex going over a cliff. And I think, you know, there's a lack of real understanding of what's happening there. And when we did our study, which was part of our book, Bringing Baby Home, what we saw is that couples, first of all, underestimated how much work a child is. They underestimated the effects of sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. And what research has shown about sleep is that you don't have to actually have less hours of sleep, but after 30 days of interrupted sleep, you are going to show almost every clinical sign of depression, including a loss of sex drive. So, you know, it's very typical for parents who are losing sleep, of course, with a new child to get more irritable, feel exhausted all the time, just want to think about the baby and nothing else. And they forget how to really connect with one another, prioritize time with one another. I've seen couples, for example, it's really funny, who they would have a date a month, an overnight where, you know, grandma and grandpa would come in, take care of the baby. They'd go for a date and they would go to a hotel, you know, thinking it would be really romantic. What would they do? They'd both fall asleep.
Which is the most romantic thing ever. No one woke us up for 9 hours and it was hot.
Oh, man.
It's true. And it's, I mean, I love that we're normalizing this because it's funny. Every time someone has a baby or they go through the situation, they think they're the only ones. I can't believe this is happening. And then you're so in it, it's almost too late. I mean, it's never too late, but it's almost like they can't even think their way out of it.
Yes.
Right. I want to get back into conflict for a minute and in relationships, because that's a lot of what we, you know, there's so many conflicts and there's so many problems that people just won't get past. They might not go to therapy. And I've always said, it seems like you're repeating the same things over and over. And then hearing your stat, 69% of conflicts are never solved. And in fact, they stay the same. So over years. So like, this is never going to change. But then yet we call these relationships still successful.
Right.
How is that possible?
Well, here's the thing. You know, the question about successful relationships isn't, do they solve all their problems? It's, again, how do they dialogue about those problems? How do they dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you were talking about compromise. Well, one of the things that is really, really important is taking the time to really understand your partner's point of view about a particular conflict and where it comes from, what it's about for them. What's the history behind that? Childhood history, other relationship history. Why is it so important to you that you have this particular position on the issue really lived? What is the underlying sense of purpose and meaning for you in having your position on the issue honored? And when you have that kind of conversation with one person as the listener and the other as the speaker, and that listener just staying with question after question to really understand the other person's point of view, and then reversing the roles so there's deeper understanding, then compromise becomes so much easier because you develop compassion and a much deeper appreciation for your partner's internal world regarding their position on a conflict issue.
Could you maybe give me some examples about how a conflict that stays the same, but how you kind of learn to zhuzh it so it works in a way?
Yeah, we call this the dreams within conflict. And we analyzed 950 of these conflicts that seemed like deal breakers, you know, where they're opposed to each other and compromise seems unthinkable because in these deal breakers, you're kind of selling yourself out if you compromise. That's the way it feels. And so after we analyzed that, and we also saw that in our own relationship as well, we found that some of these unsolvable problems become the points of better connection. So an example from our own relationship, for example, was that, you know, we now live on Orcas Island in the San Juan Islands north of Seattle. And we vacationed here when we were first married, and we really loved it. We loved canoeing on the ocean, and we really enjoyed it. And at a certain point, Julie really felt like she wanted to have a cabin on Orcas Island, a small cabin. And I was opposed to it, strongly opposed to it. And she really wanted to do it. And I didn't understand the reasons for it. I thought it was extravagant. We already had a house. We could rent. I had all kinds of objections to it. And we finally went to therapy to try to get help with this. The therapy didn't work. The therapist said to me, John, you can say no to Julie and she has to live with it. And I turned to Julie and I said, do I sound like her? And Julie said, yeah, you do. And I said, well, let's quit therapy and talk about this more deeply.
Yeah. And you're fired, so right? Not all great. Yeah, right. Not all therapists are great. A lot of bad therapy out there. Yeah.
So, you know, so she really asked me a lot of questions about why I was so opposed to this. And I asked her a lot of questions about why she wanted it so much. And we found that there were deep reasons about why I was opposed to it, which had to do with my parents having survived the Holocaust and having to flee from Austria with absolutely no possessions at all. They lost everything. And my parents always conveyed this idea that you shouldn't trust in property or things. You should only trust in what you can carry in your mind. And so the idea of trusting in property to me was terrifying, right? Yet Julie really was born in the United States and wasn't a refugee like me. And she had grown up really appreciating nature in a very deep way and wanted to be a steward of nature, which is something I didn't understand when we first married and learned to understand over time. So as we heard each other's reasons for wanting this, we decided to embark on an experiment and try it for a couple of years, buy a small place and see how it felt. And, you know, we tried the experiment and we both fell in love with having a home here.
God, I love that example because so I think the opposite of that is couples saying that it just continues to be a fight for the rest of their relationship.
Right.
You know, never let me live in the country. But you have that skill set of listening and teaching. I guess people learn this. They learn this from you, but we are not born listeners. Right. Active listening.
Right. We really learned it from the couples in the lab who, you know, took these deal breakers and asked each other questions that deepened their understanding of their partner's point of view. Hmm. And Julie really is the one who was insightful enough to see that this was an important therapy technique because of her background as a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You guys are like couples goals. Really. I just need to know how you both met. So can you just start there?
I was going to be driving about an hour to a party, and one cannot drive an hour without having coffee in your car. And so I stopped in at a little coffee cafe, and John was sitting there. I went to go order coffee, and he asked me if I'd like to sit with him for a few minutes.
Right.
So we sat together for almost an hour, which made me late to the party, but I didn't really care because he was dazzling. He was dazzling. I loved his eyes. I loved his mind. I didn't really know what he did or the fact that he was already a famous person in the academic world. But I think I just kind of fell in love right then and there.
Okay.
You fell in love with my car.
Well, this is true. I mean, his car was voted the ugliest car in the University of Washington faculty parking lot.
Right.
And I adored it. It was like a 1962 red Dodge with
right.
big white patches of Bondo all over it because he hadn't had it painted after he had all the rust patched up. And I loved his car. It was
and
just
you
the
loved his car and you loved meeting him. That's amazing. And what I heard is that John too, you had been dating too, right? For a while. Is it true that you went on 60 dates?
That's true. So when I got to Seattle, I'd been divorced for about 7 years, and I decided, you know, school hadn't started yet, and I'd get to know the city and go on as many dates as I could. So before I met Julie, I had gone out on 60 dates in 10 weeks. She was number 61,
oh,
and she was a clear outlier. I had a database.
I mean, that is incredible. Were you tracking the dates? Were you writing notes about them, or could you just, mm-hmm. you just kept moving until you found someone that you wanted to
be? You know, I didn't think I'd find the love of my life, but I thought I'd find somebody to go to movies with or out to dinner, and I did meet people like that, but nothing compared to Julie.
Okay. You just knew.
Yeah.
And then you started working together, which I love because I've heard you also say that, I think Julie was in an interview, you said, you know, we're not relationship gurus. You know, you've just learned from a lot of the successful couples that you've worked with over the years. Be right back with more from my interview with John and Julie Gottman. We'll discuss their book, 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. If you ever wanted to get closer to your partner, and who doesn't, don't miss this. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread, so here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. I love your new 8 Dates book. It's great for couples who've been together for years or just a few months. I want to point that out. You give in-depth ideas for meaningful, communicative dates that bring couples closer together based on your research. Some of the dates are based around ideas like fun and adventure, dreams, family, work and money, spirituality, and of course, sex and intimacy. Because what I get asked a lot is that people say, oh, I don't know how to even have those conversations, but you lay it out in 8 dates. And it's very specific questions that on that date, you just get your partners. I mean, I think any partner who would want to be a good lover and be a good partner would say, yeah, once a week or let's say once a month, we'll go on a date and then just take your book as a script. You emphasize a lot about the open-ended questions rather than just the closed questions. And I think that's just a concept that is so important, because it's really how we listen, how we do deepen it, and how we start to understand. It wasn't about money. It's about your relationship to money, about your upbringing, about what you've been told about money and fears.
Right.
You know, I know a lot of couples don't want to do that walk. They just want to stay maybe more in the superficial, but hopefully not people listening to the show or coming to see you.
Yeah, the eight gates are really about keeping curiosity alive in one another. They're not confrontational. They're sort of like asking couples, well, you know, how did your parents do it? And what's your background? What's your history with getting angry? What's your history with conflict? I don't know, how do you like to talk about things? And, you know, what do you feel about commitment and trust? How did your parents show that they were trustworthy or failed to do that? You know, how can we feel more trusted in one another? Those kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we field tested the dates with 350 couples who recorded their dates. So we really know they work.
Right. Some of the questions that can help deepen the understanding of your partner's point of view are included in your book. Like, did you have any dreams for yourself when you were a child? Did your parents support you in fulfilling your childhood dreams? And is there an underlying purpose for fulfilling your dream? And answering these with a partner can be super powerful. So maybe you can like walk us through, because I think we're going to hit on a lot of things there. You know, some of the dates, some of the most important of the sex, of the date, not sex date. Okay, I want to talk about the sex date. I do. But there's a few, which dates do you find the most, you know, there's the conflict date, the money date, the sex date.
The first date turned out to be in a lot of ways the most powerful emotionally, where they're talking about trust and commitment. You know, can you lean on me? Are you going to be there for me? And what's been your experience in other relationships? And what did you see with your own family? How did people show one another that they could really be there, count on that person to be there in hard times? You know, we say that in the wedding vows, right? Sickness and health and, you know, for better or for worse. But how do you actually act when things are worse? Mm-hmm. So that conversation turned out to have a lot of juice. People really wanted to talk about commitment and trust.
Yeah.
What's your favorite date, Julie?
Yeah. What's your favorite date?
I think my favorite is the date on dreams. Not nighttime dreams, but looking at your own dreams for your own life. You know, we get so caught up in the minuscule, in the tasks, in the pick up the laundry, in who's going to make dinner tonight, you know, all that stuff. What happened at work today? However, all of us are philosophers. Every single person, no matter what your education is, all of us have built a system of values, and we look at the sense of purpose and meaning in our lives only in little tiny glimmers of light over the course of our life. It's so very difficult for us to carve out time to think about, okay, what do I dream about doing? What do I dream about being? Who do I want to be as a human being? How do I want to give to the world? What's my dream of the legacy I want to leave behind? What great adventures have I dreamed about doing that at this point seem impossible, but they still, you know, linger in my mind? So it's a sharing of those deeper layers that we normally do not enter into because our lives are so cluttered. So cluttered with tasks and trivia. Mm-hmm. So that date I adore. Mm-hmm. The other thing too is that, you know, everybody shares dreams and so on when they first get together and when they, you know, commit to one another and so on, then you get busy. Well, the reality is that over the course of time, people change. Experience changes us. The history that we're living through, for example, this pandemic, is changing people so dramatically, not only superficially, but at a much deeper level in terms of their values, in terms of what they dream about doing when they can finally get out, you know, in the world with safety. So sharing those thoughts and how your dreams have changed over the decades can be really a momentous conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. We do often share that when we start dating somebody, and maybe that's what even attracts you to them, that they have these dreams and passions of who they're going to be and what they're going to do. But then life gets busy and you have a kid and it is about the laundry and paying the bills. And slowly but surely, each one of you have little dreams that are dying. Like maybe every year they're just getting a little bit more repressed. And so to have it, to be able to talk about it and say, you know, this is still important to me. This is who I am. And I think this might be the antidote to, we always hear that couples grew apart. Well, we just grew apart. Well, this would kind of prevent that if you kept kind of monitoring. Well, we grew apart because I was going after my dream. I mean, I've heard this is sort of a cliche example, but well, I was home with the kids, but you were out doing this thing and you were out living your life and I didn't get to live my dream. So I guess I just love this idea of getting people to stick with these conversations that why you fell in love and what attracted you to each other.
Right.
It's so important.
Yeah.
Right.
How important are the similarities versus the differences in people's dreams and people's personalities and how they move through the world?
There is a huge myth out there. It's probably the most common myth about relationships, that you have to be compatible. And how compatible are you? But the reality is that, you know, if you're truly compatible, you're a clone of the other person and you get bored silly relating to them, right? So you really want to have a person who is different from you, and that is fine. That is great. The key to really having a successful relationship when your dreams are very different from the other person's is, do you support each other's dreams even though they're not yours? Now, there's going to be exceptions to that where your partner's dream is your nightmare. Well, okay, that's, you know, not going to happen probably.
After the break, John and Julie break down what the research shows about the difference between successful and unsuccessful couples. So you want to take notes, be right back. Let's get into sex real quick in relationships, mm-hmm. because I want to talk about, like, specifically the role of sex. And I loved your chapter in your book, 8 Dates, because it brings to light how different people approach and experience talking about sex. I mean, I encourage people to talk about sex all the time. And one of the big things I always say, people are like, what are the top questions you get asked? And I say, people just always want to know if they're normal. And I'm always like, it's okay. It's okay. Masturbation's okay. You want sex once. And people are like, how? And people want to know, should I be having sex once a week, 10 times a week? I said, well, it's what works for you in the relationship. I'm not here. I'm not the numbers police or the sex police. I'm not going to knock on your door and say, you didn't have sex enough this week. But can you talk about what are the traits of couples that you found that have a great sex life?
The largest study ever done on this question was done with 70,000 couples. And in 24 different countries, and they had that one question: what's different about people who say they have a great sex life compared to people who say they have a bad sex life? Mm-hmm. And, you know, reading that study, I was able to list about a baker's dozen of things that people did who had a great sex life. And none of them had to do with what happened in the bedroom. They were all things like, people have a great sex life, tell each other they love them and mean it. Every day, they ask questions, they give compliments, they give surprise romantic gifts, they cuddle, they know their partner's preferences sexually, they know their partner's sort of inner world of desire, what turns them on and turns them off. And, you know, they really stay good friends. And that's so fascinating, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also, successful couples are really, really good at both initiating and refusing sex without putting pressure on the other person. So I'll give you an example. I had a couple where he wanted more sex than she did. This was a hetero couple, and she had a history of sexual abuse. And so when he would initiate and she would refuse, he would get angry at her. And the anger felt like a reenactment of the sexual abuse in the sense that if she didn't conform to his desire and do what he wanted, then she was a bad person. Right? And that's oftentimes how a perpetrator will make a sexual abuse survivor feel.
Yeah, she's re-traumatized every time, right?
That's right. So she was re-traumatized every single time. I mean, it was a very, very difficult case, very difficult situation. But what ended up happening that really, really helped is this was a woman who came from a deeply religious background and had never had anything more than a kiss on the cheek. He had been married three times before and was a porn addict, right? So what he expected of her was complete pornographic sex, basically, with him in control all the time. And it was scheduled according to his needs, which was three times a week at 9 p.m. So we stopped all of the sex. She had no idea of what she liked at all, zero, because it had all been his preference. And so I gave her one of my favorite books in the whole wide world by Lonnie Barbach called For Yourself, Female Sexuality.
I told my mom when I was like 20, I'd never had an orgasm. I didn't know what masturbation, I was like 20-something in college. My friends, I said, Mom, I never even had an orgasm. She gave me that book, Lonnie Barbach, For Yourself, and I still have it on my shelf. It was my first masturbation book. Anyway, I've never heard anyone else bring it up, so that was a moment. Okay.
Yeah, Emily.
Lonnie Barbach, yeah.
And your mother was just spot on. Yeah. Good for her, because it's one of the best books ever written for women, and Lonnie went on to create programs to help women with their own sexuality, videos, more books, and so on. She's really been a huge contributor, especially for women in the field of sex. So this woman read the book, did all the exercises by herself, and by the end of about 8 months or so, which is what it took her, during which they were abstinent, by golly, then she could ask him for what she needed and what she wanted. And the reality was that, you know, he knew she wasn't there really emotionally. She was more like a zombie who was putting up with his sexual needs. And he missed her. He missed her. He felt lonely. He felt disconnected when they had sex. So now they were able to move back into having a sexual relationship in which both of their needs mattered, with hers mattering first, more so, and then eventually reaching a balance, where they were so much more fulfilled because she learned what she loved sexually and sensually and could convey that, had to tell him specifically. And this woman didn't know she had a clitoris, right?
But a lot of women don't. But what I love that you're saying, and it reinforces something that we talk about a lot here, is that a lot of people, we just haven't done the work. We just, and a lot of women who were raised to kind of be more performative during sex or just kind of give up and kind of fake orgasms. It just, you have to take time. It might be 8 months. It might be, you know, 8 weeks. You just study it and you say, I'm going to figure out what I want so I can come back to you and show up as a fully, you know, more sexual being, and not looking at our sexuality in the eyes of our partners, but sort of figuring out what we want. You also talk about methods for initiating sex in chapter 3 of your book, Let's Get It On. And for listeners at home, an indirect request for sex would be like, why don't we have sex anymore? Whereas a direct request would be more like, hey, want to have sex? Or initiating using touch.
Yeah.
So much more effective.
Gay and lesbian couples are more likely to be direct than heterosexual couples.
Yeah. Also, they talk about the importance of kissing. I know kissing is so important. Have you found that kissing is the first thing that goes in long-term relationships? And I think you have found in some studies how important kissing is.
There's a German study that shows that German men who kiss their wives goodbye when they leave for work live 5 years longer than German men who do not.
That's not a good enough example for everybody to kiss your partner before you go to work. I don't know what is. I mean, come on. How hard is that? But we're really talking about constant connection and communication.
Right.
Right.
Are the healthiest thing that we see in relationships. Mm-hmm. Real quickly, can we talk about pheromones and attraction?
Sure.
I know it's a big question, but I get asked it all the time. Like, what is attraction? Do we have to be the same? And I know the t-shirt study and all the things, but what is that about?
Yeah, Klaus Wedekind, a German researcher, found that women prefer the smell of t-shirts that men wore for a couple of days. When the men are most different from them genetically, just in terms of the genes of the immune system. So that women are much more interested in men who are genetically diverse from them. And that has an obvious evolutionary advantage for your children. You know, if you have the genes of very different immune systems, your children are more protected. But here's this unconscious process happening, and it's coming out in smell and other things that we probably aren't measuring. And the study was done, would those women actually like those men better, whose smells they like better? And that study was done, and it's true, they do like them better. So, you know, here we are, we're selecting people who are very different from us, and we're most attracted to people who are very different from us. And the big mistake that people make is once they get together, if they try to turn their partner into them by being critical, then the relationship is going to go south. As opposed to really accepting the differences and really learning from and benefiting from those and celebrating those differences. Mm-hmm. Right.
How can we bring the t-shirt study into day? I'm just trying to think through all of your work and everything I read and study. It's like you guys have the answers and everyone's running around trying to figure it out. Is there a way to kind of hack attractions? Can we do a little mini t-shirt study? Like, how can we find out that we're making these choices of the right partner? Like, what are there anything quick answers or things that we can just know that these are the things that have to be in place before you walk down the aisle or even go on the third date? Is there any way to know?
So we have an app that is free that people can download. If they go to the app store and type Gottman card decks, one of the card decks is 100 questions you can ask a woman about her inner erotic world and 100 questions you can ask a man about his inner erotic world. And they can download that for free. It's been downloaded 350,000 times so far. And then they can know if they're sexually compatible.
I love it. I love your app. I'm just telling you, I have it. I recommend it all the time. Maybe I'm responsible for like 20 of those downloads, but yeah, it's so well done.
But to address the broader question, you asked, how can you know that you're really looking at somebody who you can have a really good relationship with. Mm-hmm. So attraction, of course, is a really important thing. But I would say there are several other factors that are really important. One is, does your partner actually do what he or she or they say they're going to do? In other words, do they follow through with what they say they're going to do? Because a lot of times people will experience, oh, I'll call you next week, and then they never do. So leave that one. Secondly, are they there for you when you need them in all kinds of different situations? Are they there for you when you want to celebrate a triumph? Are they there for you when you want to talk about a defeat? Are they there for you when you're physically sick? Are they there for you when you're depressed? Are they there for you when you want to go out and have a fabulous, you know, ecstatic, spontaneous, fun time? Are they there for you when you really need help with your kid? Are they there for you? That's probably the biggest question, along with sexual attraction.
Yeah.
That really makes a big difference.
Speaks to trust.
Okay. I guess all the time, like if I wasn't I was never really attracted to my partner, but now I'm wondering if I could learn to be attracted to them. Like they're my best friend. We do everything together. I love them. Their family loves me. I love them. But the sex wasn't there. Do you think you can create that if it wasn't there in the beginning?
It depends on what it is that you want to create. If you want to create a really hot, vibrant, really super duper passionate sex life, probably not.
Yeah.
However, if you want to create a sex life that is tender, that is loving, that is sweet, that is satisfying sexually, but may not be the hottest, most passionate thing in the whole wide world with fireworks, good enough.
Yeah. I guess it's deciding what sex, the importance of what it means to you. Again,
good enough.
Defining what sex means to you. Good enough. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. I have a few more questions. This is from our Instagram. We told our Instagram audience you were coming on the show and they were very happy. So we have a few questions. This is from someone who says, we have a toddler and a baby. There is no gas left in the tank and we're losing our connection and chemistry. Help.
Date night. Date night, date night, date night. Go on a date once a week. No matter what, have a bank of babysitters you can call upon and go on a date. You've got to give the relationship some priority and some connection and take along with you maybe the book and just have a conversation that helps you draw closer emotionally, but sit very close together on a couch somewhere. John and I, when we didn't have much money, we would go in Seattle to a hotel that had the most beautiful lobby in the whole wide world. It was dimly lit, huge stone fireplace, big soft couches in front of it. We would go there, we'd commandeer a couch, pretending we were guests, and we would order one drink each, and we'd just sit in front of the fire and talk for 3 or 4 hours, and then we'd go home. Fabulous.
Non-negotiable date nights. I think you even have some studies about that, that couples who stick with the date night are the most successful. Okay, here's another one. Steps to take while single to attract a healthy relationship.
Mm. So first of all, how do you meet somebody? Where do you meet them? You're probably not going to meet them at a bar. People go to bars for different reasons than finding the love of their life. So also, don't drink a lot. Use a lot of drugs when you're first meeting somebody. You want to be sober, clear-eyed, clear-minded, so that you can really sense who this person is. Right?
And be yourself.
And be yourself, right.
Yourself. I love it. Okay, one more. How do couples address differing views of vulnerability and intimacy in sex?
One of the things is that if a person doesn't have the vocabulary to be more vulnerable, maybe they can be more vulnerable through touch. So will they allow themselves, for example, to just be a receiver and receive touch from you that varies in all kinds of ways in terms of sensuality, and to tell you what they like and what they don't like? So, you know, one's a receiver, one's a giver. And you can touch them with your fingers. You can touch them with a piece of velvet. You can touch them with a feather. You can touch them all over their body. Where do they like to be touched the most? And when they really like it, why do they like it? What feels good about it? What does it remind them of that makes them feel so good?
Mm-hmm. So it's a gradual opening. When people feel more safe, they'll want to open up and be vulnerable. And I think Brené Brown has really talked so much about this in a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. I love her. Okay, you guys, thank you so much. John and Julie Gottman, this is amazing. Now, I have 5 quickie questions we ask all of our guests, and they're quick. It can be one answer, one sentence. Okay, ready? What is your biggest turn on?
Listening to blues music. Love it. Mm-hmm.
John, what about you?
Really taking a walk with Julie and our puppy.
Oh, you have a puppy too? Okay. Mm-hmm. I love it. Biggest turn off.
Watching a TV show where men are being violent against women.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be mine too.
Okay. What makes good sex?
really feeling emotionally connected and safe.
Just being with Julie.
Oh, something you would tell your younger self about sex and relationships.
Don't give yourself away so easily.
It'll happen. Don't worry.
Oh, and it happened. Okay. What's the number one thing you wish everyone knew about sex?
There's huge variation. Everything is acceptable.
That's all okay. I love that.
Except hurting the other person when they haven't consented to it.
It's not rocket science. It's sex isn't so difficult. And it's really about affection and caring and emotional connection and that becoming physical connection as well.
Great. I love it. Thank you both for being here so much. This was such an honor. This was a wonderful interview. And I just thank you for all the work that you do. I appreciate
you
so
Emily.
Much.
Thank
yeah,
you.
This was
You're
great.
A wonderful interviewer.
Oh, thank you. That's it for today's episode. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share this with a friend or a partner. Believe me, if you got something out of this, they will too. We release 2 to 3 episodes a week. Find me on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. It's all at Sex with Emily. If you want to ask me a question about sex, dating, or relationships, you can email me feedback@sexwithemily.com or sexwithemily.com/askemily. And check out my website. We have so many articles on there helping you better sex. And you can check out our guides at sexwithemily.com/guides for free guides that will give you expansive tips and activities. Sign up for our weekly emails because, hey, I've been told I give really good emails. Was it good for you? Email me feedback@sexwithemily.com.